at the governance behind the country as well, and are we best set up to cope with these kind of structural issues in the short, medium term?
Maybe because they are same, jealous, like who is too close to each other, have competition, like two brothers, like two sisters, I don't know, maybe two same, and the same story, the same relationship with other countries and all that kind of thing, maybe jealous, maybe other fights. Interesting.
Well, some things you get right and then other things it takes a bit longer to get right, so I hope they work on it.
I think you have to ask Macron. It seems to be down to him causing all this fuss. I don't know if the French people feel the same way as him, but it'd be interesting to get their views.
In 1975, the United Kingdom and Iceland had a dispute about fishing rights. It was called the Cod War, and Iceland won. Can there be a winner between Britain and France this time? And if so, how and why?
I don't think there'll be a winner. I just think there's a whole load of, you know, people trying to show off, you know, basically, for want of a better word, almost like a competition between each other. I think it will just die down. I don't think anything will come of it.
Well, with fighting, as you have described, is going on, I don't think there is ever a winner. Eventually, every fight ends with a sit-down and an agreement. So the sooner they do that, the better for everyone involved, I guess.
In my opinion, it's not about winning or no. It's just about getting the best, like the best you can do for your people. So the French government was the best for the French fishers, so such does the UK government for their fishers. So at the end, it's all about what you're gonna get at the end. But I'm not sure anyone can win. Just it's gonna be just like who's gonna have the best agreement and people like appear in the country. That's all it's gonna be about.
No, there will be no winner. That's typical of a rule. There's no winner. There's much. It's a lose-lose or a win-win. So we have to find an agreement. Otherwise, it's ridiculous. On that, to me, it's ridiculous. We have to find an agreement, and there will be no winner, for sure.
I think they're going to lose both sides. Yeah, because if they don't enter into a conclusion, you know, which one pushes to one to another, you know. I don't think they're going to win, neither of them.
I don't think you can both be winners. I think we've got to come to a compromise and get on with it.
There's a war mentality in this country always. We like to think of things in that kind of guise. But I really think that if you look at the next kind of few years and the bedding in of Brexit, we've really got to get past that and try and rebuild as a country. And we need our partners to help us do that. So, you know, I'd like to think that obviously Boris and Macron can be on the same page at some point and look at common agreement and what unites us rather than what divides.
I think it's like most relationships, eh? Go through a rocky bit and hopefully we'll get it back on track. But no, it's just not nice to see, is it?
I think, you know, the British at the moment, you know, quite frankly should be eating more of their own fish rather than exporting it. And maybe this might cause us to try and actually stop selling it all abroad and get it sold over here, which could be a benefit. But I think there's much more iterations to come in this war at the moment.
I think probably both will lose out in the long run. I think both fishermen will always want to get in each other's waters, I think, and so they can never really be a winner.
They lose always. Fight is always a losing game. I don't know, but I don't know what will happen with that boat. I will follow that story.
This is a lose-lose situation. It's not a win-win situation for either. It's a lose-lose situation. I mean, at the end of the day, we're both in Europe. You know, you can't separate Britain from Europe. They're still our biggest trading partner. Actually, it's number one trading partner. And then you've got the Americans, and then you have other trading blocks. So I think the best thing is just to come back on the talk and be mature about it. No one's going to win this one. UK or France, no one's going to win this one. To win is to talk.
Well, yeah, because that fish is obviously going off, so that's going to be a waste of stock. And yeah, there could be other issues. You can't just have that boat sitting there. It's probably stopping other boats from getting out. So yeah, it's going to have a knock-on effect. It needs to be resolved pronto, really, I think.
In the past, the UK and France have worked closely together. They jointly built the Concorde supersonic airliner, which led to the establishment of the world-beating Airbus aviation business. But with the French president and the British prime minister both weathering a very public conflict between the two nations, there is no sign of what used to be called an entente cordiale today. The UK and France have been locked in a bitter standoff about fishing rights. But the true dispute is not about fish at all. After evidence that French politicians want the UK to be punished for leaving the European Union, this has become a very public argument between old allies. And while this will not lead to war, the history of European politics tells us that when two large European nations collide, there are no winners, only degrees of losing.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The defeat in Afghanistan offers a chance to rethink America's war machine, but Congress is on the verge of raising military spending to $740 billion. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Peter Moss, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After Afghanistan Disaster, the Pentagon is on track to get even more money. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Afghanistan was supposed to be the good war after 9/11, the one with a legitimate purpose and a happy ending. That also didn't turn out to be true. But while the war's momentum favored the Taliban for years, its final act had the suddenness of a guillotine with a lot more pain. At Kabul's airport, desperate Afghans clung to the sides of the departing U.S. cargo plane. Panicked families tried to get onto the diminishing number of evacuation flights, and 13 U.S. troops helping keep the airport open were killed in a suicide bombing. Just before midnight on August 30, the last U.S. aircraft and the last U.S. soldier got out of Kabul. This defeat could have been an opportunity to rethink the logic of America's war machine. That's what defeats often do. They force you to reconsider the destructive tendencies that got you into the hole. One of those tendencies has been a nearly ceaseless rise in military spending that has little popular support. Even before the fall of Kabul, opinion polls consistently showed that only a minority of Americans think that the U.S. should spend more on its defense. Just 26% in a survey conducted by Gallup in February. And on the day that the U.S. got out of Afghanistan, Representative Barbara Lee, the lone member of Congress to vote against the invasion in 2001, called the Republicans as well as Democrats to finally reconfigure the nation's spending priorities. Now is the time to shift our investments away from endless wars and toward addressing human needs, she said. To understand the next step, you need to go back to April when President Joe Biden proposed a $715 billion Pentagon budget for 2022, which represented a 1.6% increase from 2021. Progressives likely were not pleased and were even less pleased in late July when the Senate Armed Services Committee added $25 billion to Biden's proposal. This plus-up, as it's called, raised the budget to $740 billion, a 5% increase over the previous year. At that rate, military spending over the next decade would easily exceed $7 trillion, or four times more than the $1.75 trillion Build Back Better program that Biden is trying to push through Congress. That was the legislative prelude to Lee's call for new priorities. 2 days later, on September 2nd, the House Armed Services Committee met to consider the military budget and, as expected, an amendment was introduced by the ranking Republican to match the Senate increase. This set off a debate in which one of the strongest backers of the plus-up was a Democrat representative, Ellen Luria, a former Navy officer whose Virginia district includes the naval station in Norfolk. In one word, we can sum up the why and that China, Luria said. We are ending our longest conflict of 20 years, but more than ever, the world is watching what we do here today. Right now, there are malign actors who seek to attack us and do us harm, she said. This has been a reliable power move over the decades. When one threat fades away, another seems to come along at the right time. The so-called War on Terror is a spent force, but now there is China, as they claim, which devotes two-thirds less to its defense than the U.S. and is not known to be planning any 9/11-style attack on the homeland, but is having a conveniently timed Sputnik moment. In the end, the committee voted 42-17 to increase the budget, with 14 Democrats joining 28 Republicans. The committee spent far more time debating critical race theory, but about 2 hours than the amendment to cut the budget about 30 minutes. It's as if we have learned nothing from the past 20 years, said Representative Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat from California, during the debate. She noted that rather than pumping money into the military, more resources could go toward diplomacy, education, infrastructure, and public health. That is what will determine if we are competitive with China, not whether we have more F-35 that even the Pentagon says they don't need, she concluded. The fundamental idea behind her argument was evoked during the Vietnam War by Martin Luther King Jr., who warned in 1967, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. If you want to understand the soul-killing trajectory of U.S. military spending, you should look at a recent home purchase in Beverly Hills, California. Last month, a wealthy buyer paid $20.9 million for a mansion with 8,600 square feet of living space that includes 5 bedrooms, 7 bathrooms, and an interior courtyard with an olive tree. The buyer's name, according to a news article that was widely shared on social media, is Daud Wardak. Little is known about Wardak except that his father was a defense minister in Afghanistan, and his older brother founded an obscure logistics company that landed more than $250 million in U.S. military contracts. It's not clear how Wardak was able to purchase his new residence or the $5.2 million condo he also owns in Miami Beach, Florida. But what's known is that nearly half of U.S. military expenditures since 9/11, total is about $14 trillion, have gone to contractors. Some are global brands of lethality, such as Raytheon and General Dynamics, while others are pop-up entities with headquarters that are post office boxes. The money that has vanished through corruption is legendary as well as unknowable. Because the Pentagon has never passed an audit, and until recently it didn't even try to conduct one. It's a scenario of national deformation that was predicted in 1961 by President Dwight Eisenhower, who warned in his farewell address of the rise of a military-industrial complex. The numbers behind this deformation are stunning. Since 2001, the five largest weapons manufacturers in the U.S. have spent more than $1.1 billion lobbying the government, and the statistics doesn't even include their donations to candidates, the funding of think tanks, or their payments to generals who become board members. These investments have paid off, according to Stephen Semler of the Security Policy Reform Institute, which calculates that those five firms have received more than $2 trillion in government contracts since 2001.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Saudi-led coalition seized three fuel tankers heading for war-torn Yemen nearly 3 months ago. On Saturday, Yemen's petroleum company put out a statement slamming the Saudi-led coalition's illegal confiscation of three oil ships carrying a collective amount of over 80,000 tons of diesel and preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah. Saudi Arabia still prevents vessels from docking in Hodeidah port despite them having received UN permits for sailing in international waters. Earlier this year, Yemen's Minister of Oil and Minerals, Ahmed Abdullah Dares, warned that the Saudi seizure of ships carrying petroleum products could lead to the suspension of the service sectors and cause a humanitarian catastrophe. The fuel blockade contributes to a much broader Saudi-led blockade campaign against Yemenis. The coalition's military forces have stopped planes from landing and ships from docking in Yemen. Many critics had prophesied that the blockade would keep much-needed food, fuel, medicine, and humanitarian aid from reaching desperate Yemenis, including millions of children. In fact, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. Also, over 16 million Yemenis are on the brink of acute starvation. That's almost half of the country's population. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by the U.S., launched a war on Yemen. Their goal was to reinstate the friendly government of Abdurrabu Mansur Hadi and to eliminate the Ansarullah movement. However, so far they've failed, and the war has only left tens of thousands of people dead and millions more displaced.
There's been a history of the United Nations failing in the region, and as far away as 2016, the UK blocked a call for the establishment of an independent international inquiry So we can see the United Nations is really controlled by members who have really no interest in the human rights of the people of Yemen.
The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, describing the country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing fuel blockade against Yemen has led to food and medicine shortages. These items cannot be transported without fuel. Also, many hospitals experience power outages as they do not have enough power to keep the lights on amid the coronavirus pandemic. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden refuses to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen and stopping its deadly airstrikes. On the other hand, it tries to change the narrative in favor of the kingdom. For instance, Washington refuses to blame Riyadh for the current fuel shortage in Yemen. The U.S. says the Saudi coalition only blocks ships and planes that the Hadi government doesn't grant permission to. Therefore, it's the Hadi government that's imposing the blockade. But Washington's shameless support for Saudi Arabia doesn't end here. The Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale follows the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The sale flatly contradicts Biden's sayings during the first major foreign policy speech of his presidency that the U.S. is ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen.
Well, some people believe that America's economy is built around merchandising death in general. The sale of $650 million recently, this week, to Saudi Arabia by the U.S. is really, from their position, the support of the U.S. foreign policy to the national security interests of the United States.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia, saying it proves Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering and that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The arms supplies to Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. But it seems the green Saudi dollars are worth a lot more to the U.S. than the lives of innocent Yemeni civilians and children.
Tensions are simmering in Ethiopia, where a year-long war between government forces and fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is feared to intensify. The TPLF is the party ruling in the northern Tigray region. It used to hold power in Ethiopia until the parliamentary elections in 2018, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took over with the support of country's largest ethnic groups, the Oromo and Amhara. On Friday, however, eight rebel groups, including the Oromo Liberation Front, agreed in Washington to join forces with the TPLF to form a coalition against the government, striking up an alliance between the historic foes.
The main reason why this alliance is significant is it's another example of them using this level of psychological warfare. This particular announcement, and what I would like to say grandiose event in D.C., coupled with the media's focus of the armies marching to the Capitol in the last few days, is just another way to create this level of manufactured consent from the people so they can feel as though, wow, well, the Ethiopian government is already lost, so I must try to put my hope into TPLF or this alliance in some case.
Ethiopia declared a nationwide state of emergency on the 2nd of November amid concerns that the forces, which are now within a day's drive from the capital Addis Ababa, may be considering attacking the city. The United Nations Security Council called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia on Friday, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further call to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The council members also called for unhindered access for humanitarian aid and the reestablishment of public services, among others. The announcement of the alliance between 9 Ethiopian rebel groups in Washington coincided with the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman's meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister amid calls for an immediate ceasefire and talks to end the war.
It's really interesting to note that TPLF has had a long-standing relationship to the U.S. and other European powers. I mean, the evidence here is, look at the ruling party within TPLF or the different officials and generals, and look at their assets and where they're stored.
The United Nations published a report this week that suggests both sides of the conflict have committed atrocities that may amount to war crimes. The conflict in the Tigray region erupted on November 4th last year, when Ethiopia launched an offensive against the TPLF troops who allegedly attacked a federal army camp. The government declared victory at the end of November, but clashes have continued in the region. Soon after the start of the conflict, Eritrea, TPLF's longtime enemy, joined Ethiopia in attacking the rebels. The UN report suggests that Eritrean troops have also killed hundreds of civilians in Tigray in a matter of days. Due to a communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the extent of humanitarian crisis in the region. The fate of millions of Ethiopians is now hanging in the balance, with no end in sight for their persecution in the absence of any meaningful international action.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region. Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the U.S. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The U.S. has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And U.S. President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
The naval forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation on the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker, using several helicopters and warships, but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this. And we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran and the people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security. The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe across Egypt through the Suez Canal and leads into the Indian Ocean.
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall, just a few weeks ago in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S., that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now, talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks will fail.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's message, which he had issued to the seminaries and ulema in the last month of his life. We discussed the Imam's views on the struggles of ulema and their sacrifices in the way of God to awaken people and to confront oppression on the one hand and sanctimony on the other. The Imam has pointed out that the true ulema have always been supportive of the downtrodden and the oppressed strata against tyrannical and puppet rulers. We also discussed Imam Khomeini's warning in his testimony to the seminaries and great ulema against deviation. Stay tuned to follow the discussion. One of the important axes that have been stressed in Imam Khomeini's testimony is the necessity of new organization in the structure of seminaries. The Imam, as a pioneer in this field, believed that if the seminaries did not embark on reform and development under the supervision of the sources of emulation and great ulema, others would step in for the purpose with wicked goals. This had been experienced during the rule of illiterate and ruthless Reza Khan, whose real aim was to obliterate ulema and Islam in Iran. Therefore, during the era of Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini strove to reform the seminaries, especially that of Qom, but he faced obstructionism of opportunities and dogmatic elements who had infiltrated the ranks of clergymen under the guise of benevolent persons. Imam Khomeini was very concerned about reformation of the structure of seminaries, even when he was in exile. Imam Khomeini's warnings during the tough times in Najaf would arouse committed ulema and young students to reform the seminaries. He made all these efforts alongside his struggles for the Islamic Revolution. He told the students and ulema, "You will be able to remove these corruptions and difficulties and thwart their colonial schemes only through self-expurgation, preparation and proper order. If you do not reform yourselves, do not become equipped and do not make order and discipline rule over your lessons and life, you will be, God forbid, doomed to destruction in the future, before losing the opportunity and before the enemy gains access to all your religious and scientific affairs. Ponder, wake up and rise up. In the first phase, embark on self-expurgation, purification, and reformation. Become equipped and orderly. Set up order and discipline in seminaries. Do not let others come and make seminaries orderly. Do not let the enemies administer the seminaries with the pretext that these people are not qualified. They cannot do anything, and they are a handful of jobless people who have gathered together in seminaries so that they would corrupt the seminaries in the name of order and reform and would subjugate you. Do not give them pretext. If you become orderly and self-expurgated and all your affairs are orderly, others would not have view upon you and would not find way to infiltrate the seminaries and the community of clergymen. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution and foundation of the Islamic Republic in Iran, naturally the necessity of new organization in seminaries was highlighted more than ever. As the grounds were set for this purpose, Imam Khomeini was more sensitive on the issue. He writes in his testimony, "I recommend for all eras, especially the current era, as the schemes and plots have become faster and stronger, that the uprising for organization of seminaries is necessary and essential, so that the ulema and great figures would spend time and, through accurate program, preserve seminaries, especially the Qom seminary and other great and important seminaries against ills in this juncture in time." Another serious concern of Imam Khomeini with regards to the ulema and seminaries was his high emphasis on safeguarding the traditional jurisprudence known as Fiqh-e-Jawahiri or Jawahiri jurisprudence. He writes in his historical message, "As for education and research in seminaries, I believe in the traditional jurisprudence and Jawahiri ijtihad and do not consider as permissible to disregard it. Ijtihad, independent reasoning on the basis of the Quran and Hadith, is correct on the same basis, but it does not mean that the jurisprudence of Islam is not dynamic. Time and place are two determining elements in ijtihad. What used to have an edict in the past, it seems that the same issue may get a new edict in terms of the relations ruling on politics, society, and economy of system. A jurisprudent should smartly and sharply guide a great Islamic and even non-Islamic society. And beside sincerity, God-wariness, and asceticism, which are worth a jurisprudent, should be really a prudent manager. Imam Khomeini points to this issue in his testimony too. It is necessary that the respectable ulema and teachers not allow lessons that are related to jurisprudence, and the jurisprudential seminaries of the grand ulema, which are the only way for preservation of the Islamic jurisprudence, to become deviated and try to increase precision, debate, discussion, and research every day. The traditional jurisprudence, which is the heritage of the righteous predecessors, and deviation from it will weaken the pillars of research and erudition, must be preserved, and researches should be increased. Of course, programs will be prepared in other sciences concerning the needs of the country, and Islam and people should be trained in those fields. Dear listeners, next time we will continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
There will be no trial, charges, or even a disciplinary hearing for two police officers involved in killing an 80-year-old woman inside her home with a tear gas grenade. It's the latest example of French cops hurting citizens and not facing even minor consequences. At the start of the Yellow Vest movement in 2018, police were clashing with protesters in the Mediterranean city of Marseille. Algerian national Zineb Redouane was in her fourth floor apartment trying to close her shutters when she was shot and killed. Redouane was on the phone with her daughter at the time of the incident, and she reportedly said, quote, "He targeted me. The police targeted me. I made eye contact with two policemen. One fired at me. Then they got in their car and left," end quote. She died the next day from her injuries.
Et aujourd'hui?
We have suffered repression, which no president has ever permitted in the history of this country. We are not at war. We are not enemies. But the government has waged war against us simply because we oppose their decisions. Just for that, many have paid dearly.
For months, the Interior Minister falsely claimed that the death had nothing to do with the grenade and that she died of cardiac arrest. Half of Redouane's face was collapsed in by the grenade. She inhaled large amounts of tear gas.
On a subi une répression.
The government has not given one word of apology or one moment of compassion towards any victims of police brutality during the Yellow Vest era. Also, there has not been one word of condemnation for the police who have committed these acts. None of the police have been convicted, even though people have been blinded, crippled, and lost. Of course, our heart goes out to the grieving family, and the Yellow Vest will continue to remember Zainab Redouane and to demand justice.
Her family has sued the Interior Minister and other senior officials for concealing and interfering with evidence. A ballistics investigation by the NGO Disclose suggested that police fired directly at Redouane's window. Many wonder if there might have been some admission of wrongdoing if the victim wasn't Arab. That appears likely, but she also joins a Yellow Vest-related casualty list, which includes 5,000 people seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life,
and 11 other deaths. Robin Mazahari, Paris.
Meet Miqdad Kawasme, a Palestinian prisoner held in an Israeli jail without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. He's among the six inmates who went on hunger strike in protest of their indefinite imprisonment weeks ago. Sunday marked the 109th day since he last ate. Israeli medics forcibly injected him with nutrients on the 92nd day of its strike. Other hunger strikers are Kayat Al-Fasfus, Ala Arraj, Hisham Abu Hawash, Ayad Huraimi, and Luay Al-Ashkar. The hunger strikers, particularly Fasfus and Kawasme, are grappling with deteriorating health conditions, with Palestinian officials warning that the inmates are at immediate risk of death. On Sunday, over 4,500 Palestinians in different Israeli jails also rejected their meals in solidarity with the six hunger strikers. Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held sit-ins and demonstrations over the past weeks demanding their immediate release. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has expressed grave concern over the lives of the prisoners. The UN body also criticized Israel's administrative detention practice, calling it a violation of international law. But no word or action is coming from Israel's powerful and influential Western allies. Experts believe the striking similarities they see with Israel to be the reason.
There is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world, and just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support, funding, and collaboration with the Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes.
Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protest at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jail. What they're fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the U.S. in May 2018 unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The U.S. and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France, and Germany, known as the P4 Plus One group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 Plus One start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the U.S. return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The U.S. has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the US and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, al-Houthi said the arms sales once again prove that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
America.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war on Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these Senate arse and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on
the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, their criminality. We are not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.